So I'm going to introduce David Golofsky. David is going to tell you what the normal program is.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Malcolm. I'm with the Schools of Home Energy Education Project. We organized this debate with support from Sheffield and Yorkshire C&D campaign against climate change, and then Sheffield Hallam, and thank you very much, Malcolm, for providing the venue. Basically, how we're going to go is that we're going to be, in a few minutes' time, after go back to Malcolm, we're going to be asking you each two questions. And then you'll have a choice of, maybe each of you have one of those, two of each one of those. If you don't, then we can get them to you. And you have an option of a green is a yes, and a red is no, or if people are colorblind, we can reverse the two. And then there'll be a third option of your doubt. Okay, so you have three options when you vote on these two questions. The same two questions will be asked you at the end of the debate. Okay? Okay. And the way it's going to proceed is that, and then, now at the end, you can pick up one of these bags, treat bags, and in it was some things about energy efficiency, something about my project. And if we run out of the bags, then there'll be the same bits without the bags. Okay? I just had 30 to recycle, and I didn't have any others. So, okay.
What about the autograph bag?
Which?
The autograph bag. Never mind.
Anyway, and then lastly, there will be a card, a postal card that you want to pick up. We'll explain at the end. After, and then also, there's a registration sheet. And what I want you to do is decide if you want any of these presentations. I can send them to you electronically. And then you will then state on the registration sheet which ones you want. And then they'll be sent to you electronically, or if you want me to post them to you, then you just have to leave me money for postage. Okay, and I'll say whatever you, it depends if you live in China, it may be a bit more. Okay. All right then, so we're going to proceed now, going back to Malcolm now, and then we'll carry on. Oh, then lastly, just to tell you, the five presenters will give their presentations, then go straight into the questions. We're very limited with time, so you'll just have to cope with my direct manner. I haven't brought my Chicago baseball bat with me, so I'll just try and do it with my Barnsley language. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so we're looking at nuclear energy, but a lot of this is stemmed from the Energy White Paper, and we want to look at low carbon, fuel poverty, competitiveness, and energy reliability. And all of these are going to come in this evening. If we get fuel poverty again, then we might have some of the problems of people that can't afford to heat their homes or get condensation. These are the problems we had in the 1980s. And the Labour government has got some credit that they have reduced the amount of fuel poverty. But lots of people think that if we don't get the mix right, then we could end up in this situation again. What's happening now is that fuel power stations are closing down. We're going to lose about 30% of the current power stations, and we're going to need to have an alternative to the power stations that are closing down. And one of the subhead titles of the meeting is keeping the lights on, and if we don't get it right, then the lights may go out. Okay, well, in fact, we are going to go nuclear, so why have this debate? But in the long term, we'll have solar energy, which is a nuclear reactor, and in the long term, we may also have nuclear fusion. But they're long term, we're not discussing tonight. What we are looking at is, do we want to have a new generation of nuclear power stations? And we're going to concentrate on the new nuclear, should we have it or should we not, or should we have a mix? So I'll now pass over to the next speaker. Thanks very much.
When you're going to do your vote.
Oh, right, the vote. Sorry. Okay, so we'll have our vote now. Okay, question one is, I can put it up on the, if I can do it here. No, one second. Let's do it over here. It's on there. Okay, now how do we get this bigger? Question one, in light of the current challenges facing... in light of the current challenges facing the UK and the world, do you feel we are compelled to have nuclear power as part of the primary energy mix? So if you can, green would be yes, red would be no, and then if you're in doubt, then you raise your hand. But raise your hand after I see the green and the red. Okay? So I'll... is yours up? Is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So 27 green. And then red. Well, the green clickers only show up the reds now, so I think it'll be easier for me to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, and are there any doubts? Raise your hand, please. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't count you, I know you too well. No, 1, 2. Well, keep your hands up, please. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 doubts. Okay. Okay, next question. There are fundamental reasons why nuclear power should not be part of the primary energy mix. So again, green is yes, red is no, and then D is doubtful. So I'll count the greens first. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'm very impressed that you can trust an American to count votes. Okay, when the greens put theirs down and the reds stay up. And I hope there are no chaps in here. You know. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 19. And then doubts? Okay, and then at the end, we're going to be asking you those questions again. Thank you very much, and I'll now, there are no absentee ballots in America, they generally don't count them anyways. And so now we'll have Andrew Smith, who will start off putting the debate in context. Thank you very much.
And it's lovely to see you. Thank you very much for coming out this evening. I'm going to romp through the basics of why we're here. You won't have time to read most of these slides, and neither will I, but they'll all be on the handout. Why we're here, for 2,000 years we managed with very flat levels of carbon dioxide. Then we discovered coal big time, and the amount of carbon dioxide in the air accelerated, which was unfortunate because that changes everything around us, and it changes all of the things that we built our civilization on, like sea levels and temperatures. And since we've been doing this for 200 years, and there's a 30 to 50 year lag in the effects,
we've now started to see global temperatures rising, global sea levels rising, and snow cover and poles falling. And the last 10 years are all in the top 15 warmest years on record. We knew this in theory 150 years ago. 40 years ago, people were saying, we only have one laboratory. Let's not destroy it in an exercise in, is this theory right? And we carried on and we've done the experiment, and yes, it turns out that greenhouse gases do increase the greenhouse effect, and now we're in trouble. And the reason is that we've been burning fossil fuels. They release carbon to the atmosphere for millions of years. This is what the world burns, 29,000 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. And Britain's contribution is 650 million tons. We're double the global average, and historically we've done pretty much more than anyone else. We've really made a big contribution to the world in quite a bad way. Here's where our pollution comes from, where it derives from. About a third of it comes from electricity. And that's good, because we can decarbonise that quite easily. Another big chunk of it, over a third, comes from heating and cars, which we can decarbonise mostly by electrifying and then decarbonising the grid. And then there's a big chunk, about a quarter, which is really tricky to get carbon out of. HGVs, planes, ships, farming. It's just, you really need a long extension lead if you're going to electrify your plane. It's difficult. The problem is that our target is 65 million tonnes. So we've got to do all of the dead easy stuff, we've got to do all of the quite easy stuff, and we've got to do quite a lot of the really hard stuff as well. So we don't have a choice about decarbonising the grid. This has to happen, and this has to happen within the next 20 years. On the left is the big red bar, which will keep coming up a few times during this presentation. That's 205 gigawatts. That's how much energy we demand in stuff. Lights, projectors, my train here, your car, petrol if you drove here. That's all in that 205 gigawatts of stuff. Almost all of it comes from fossil fuels. 194 gigawatts out of 205 gigawatts. Mean power. That's average power over 1 year, 10 years. We get 6 gigawatts from nuclear and 5 gigawatts from renewables. Now, all the nuclear is electricity, and the renewables, there's biodiesel, there's wood for heating, and there's renewable electricity as well. At the moment, that's why we're churning out so much carbon. You see the problem there? There's the big red bar again. That's still 205 gigawatts. It varies over the year. There's a big winter domestic peak. That's heating. Most of the others are pretty flat. You see, transport is about 40% of our energy needs. Most of that is the car. Industry and services, there's iron and steel, there's aluminium, there's glassworks, there's all the offices, paperwork, domestic, everything you use at home, your transport, your lighting, your heating. Of the energy demand, we throw away 107 gigawatts constantly in cooling towers, in oil refineries. So we consume 312 gigawatts. But we demand 205. We throw away a third of what we use in cooling towers and the like. We can cut our energy demand down. That's usually the cheapest and the quickest way to reduce our carbon emissions, is energy efficiency. About half of our current energy demand we could get rid of using today's technology pretty quickly by insulating homes properly, by electrifying cars, by energy efficient lighting. There's another 30% which is theoretical, and basic thermodynamics, it could be done, we just haven't invented it yet. And then underlying it all is 41 gigawatts of this is what our fundamental need is for underlying energy. I said that electricity is very easy to decarbonise. Globally, we've already decarbonised about 700 gigawatts. That's a huge amount. The red bar again is our 205 gigawatts. This is the performance over the last 27 years. So renewables have gone from practically nothing and ramped up very quickly. Hydro was very high 30 years ago and has been building. Nuclear was very low 30 years ago. Rose quickly through the 80s and into the 90s, but then has levelled up and is starting to decline in the last few years as China brings on its nuclear plants. We'll again see that accelerating. That's 700 gigawatts globally. Our global energy demand is about 15 times that, so we're not really, we made a dent, but we're not really on the way to decarbonising oil. There's a ton of stuff we're doing over the next 10 years. As Malcolm said, we're going to be retiring a lot of our current generation. It's obsolete, it's too dirty to run. Britain, along with the rest of the EU, has pledged 20% demand reduction. So that brings our 2020 demand down to 164 gigawatts. Britain is committed to 15% of that energy from renewables. It'll be 20% for Europe as a whole, but Britain was just a bit rubbish, so we got let off, and everyone else will make up for it, bless them. It's expected that by 2020 we'll have 14 gigawatts mean power. That's not installed capacity, that's mean power, a lot of it coming from the Dogger Bank. There may be some tidal barrage, although I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the arguments about the second barrage, and shouldn't we? There'll be biomass, we'll be burning waste, we'll be burning sewage. We may have photovoltaics. It's very expensive in this country because it's not that sunny. However, photovoltaics are becoming cheap very quickly, and it may be as cheap as other forms of generation in Britain in the next 10 years, perhaps. Tidal stream and wave power is in the water now, which means we'll have another option, commercially scalable, by 2015. We also have solar thermal, well established technology, biomass for heating, we've been doing for about 10,000 years, we have the hang of this. CCS, carbon capture and storage, where you capture the carbon from a coal or a gas plant and pump it underground. That, in theory, will be ready for commercial deployment by 2020, but we don't know how much it will cost, whether it will be viable long term, where fuel will come from long term, and what the net CO2 emissions will be. That may be a very good option, it may be a very bad option. We'd all love to give you firm answers on that, and it's a big giant dunno. In Britain, over the next 10 years, the picture on nuclear is clear. We will be closing our knackered old plant because it is knackered and old. However, we may or may not be building new ones, and that's what we're discussing this evening. For 2030, our options are, we can just about halve our energy demand. We've pledged to the EU, we'll make 20% cuts by 2020. There's another potential 60 gigawatts waiting there for us. We could probably build as much wind as we wanted, but there are big questions about how much wind we want. Nevertheless, the resource there is massive. The amount of wind in the North Sea, with our current technology, is enough to provide the equivalent energy as the Arabian Gulf produces in oil. It's an absolutely vast amount. By 2030, we could also build a bit of PV, 5 gigawatts. That's actually a huge amount of PV. That's every rooftop in the country. We've got scope to meet all of our home heating needs with solar thermal. We have biomass. We could get 10 gigawatts without losing any farmland. Tidal barrage, we could build it in all our major estuaries. Tidal stream and wave, with the technologies we have at the moment, we could build 3 gigawatts of tidal stream, 10 gigawatts of wave. The potential resource out there, again, is in theory massive. There are some small issues around. We don't know how to capture it, and if we did, what the effect on the ocean ecosystems would be. So there's a huge amount potentially there, another 77 gigawatts. Now 77 gigawatts, if you're trying to meet a target of 100, is huge. That's potentially a massive player. But we just don't know, it's too early to tell. We could also build 70 gigawatts of nuclear plant by then, and we could build 70 gigawatts of CCS. Rough ballpark based on expected growth in the supply chain from the International Energy Agency. And finally, Esther. There's no question that all of our low-carbon options generate net power. There's no problem there. Thanks to developments over the last 5 to 10 years, we can now balance demand and supply with pretty much any combination of supply-side technologies. We are on top of inflexibility, variability, and intermittency. You wouldn't go for 100% or one technology for a whole bunch of reasons to do with security of supply. Assuming you have no more than 70% of any, for any one technology, so if you've got 100 gigawatts of demand, no more than 70 gigawatts from any one technology, we can manage that. But our current decarbonisation path is nowhere near fast enough to meet our international responsibilities, to make up for our historic liabilities, or to maintain world leadership in 21st century technologies. We must accelerate the deployment of energy efficiency and low carbon power. And this evening we're going to discuss one option on that, and I'll now hand over to Michael Bailey.
Thank you.
To take you through some of our options on nuclear.
Thank you.
Now, where's the clicker? Right, got the technology working. I'm not saying that nuclear is the answer to all things. I think that nuclear power has a modest, time-limited, perhaps 40 years, role to play in getting us over the hump until we have both reduced our demand for energy and increased the supply for renewables, which is surely where the long-term future must be. What criteria do we need to apply? One, it must be low carbon. Two, be capable of making a significant contribution. Three, be reliable and secure. Four, be technically feasible within the required time span. Five, be politically feasible and economically possible. And I'm reminded of George Monbiot's thing, who says the cost largely depends, in terms of nuclear, upon whether you're for it or against it. Six, as free from risk as possible, recognising that all options have risks and that these risks will differ. How much energy do we need? Now, I'm drawing my stuff from David Mackay, which will differ from some of the stuff you've just had. You'll just have to cope with that. Because I can't, I'm going to stick with him. He was, you probably know, Professor of Physics at Cambridge, and last year became the Chief Scientific Advisor in the Department of Energy and Climate Change. When it comes to measuring energy, and I've been asked to use gigawatts as a unit for discussion. Now, I'm using gigawatts in the sense of the average rate of using energy, not installed capacity, nor maximum demand. For example, the national installed capacity of electricity generation might be 90 gigawatts, but it must exceed the maximum demand, which might be 75 gigawatts. Both of these are larger than the average consumption throughout the year, which might be 50 gigawatts. This last applies to how I'm using gigawatts. How much energy do we need, or at least what is our primary energy consumption? And this differs from Andrew's thing because I've included the wastage. But if we take, the important thing here, I think, is the 2050 predicted consumption, and I'm working on the 175 gigawatts. And this is one of the key points. Can we reduce that figure? It would be obviously possible to plan for a reduction, but that carries a political risk. Would such a reduction be politically acceptable? But it is a matter of debate. The Greens, for example, are working with a much lower figure. I'm going to take Mackay's figure to reduce that serious political question. Now, these figures are very similar to what we've already had. Hydro, same as it is now, waste by incineration, pumped heat, that's air source and ground source heating, wood, which uses a lot of a big area, solar hot water, biofuels, again a problem of the area that will be taken, tide and wind, these, how fully developed are those technologies, and photovoltaics, one of the things there is they indeed the question of the expense. So that's subtotal 75. Then to the big ones. Solar in deserts. Huge potential and very hopeful. So this would involve importing concentrating solar power from the Sahara. It would require a 2,000 kilometre long high voltage direct current transmission line from North Africa. Well, if it's so good, why not more? Well, it could be, but the question of energy security. What happens if Morocco or Algeria or Tunisia or Libya or Egypt decide to turn the switch off? So it is this question of balancing risk. So then on to wind. Wind is tricky. Why? One, wind takes a lot of space. A 200 megawatt wind farm needs about 100 square kilometres. Two, we live in a windy but crowded island, which imposes severe limits on what we can do, both onshore and offshore. Three, this leads to huge delays in getting planning permission and often leads to rejections. For example, one rejection was of a big wind, I think two big wind farms, in the Isle of Lewis, which has probably more reliable wind than anywhere else in Europe, in UK, if not Europe. The 20 gigawatts of wind there would require, according to Mackay's calculations, 5,300 kilometre onshore wind farms and 2,900 kilometre offshore wind farms. I'm not saying this number could not be increased, but it does face major problems, obstacles and delays. The major risk here is the delays, which is why the 20 gigawatt may actually be a realistic figure. However, I was interested to read in the report of the IMEC-E working party, they assumed 40 gigawatts by 2050. So that's obviously an important one. Clean coal. Well, as Andrew mentioned, is CCS going to work? We can't be sure. This being so, it seems irresponsible to rely on CCS as part of the energy package. Planning must assume that it may not be feasible. This is one of the strongest arguments for nuclear at this stage. Clean coal might be able to make a major contribution, but we will not know until it is too late to start building the necessary nuclear power stations which will be needed to fill the energy gap. Also, how low carbon would it be? Nuclear obviously comes with risks. Russell will deal with some of the detail of this, but if we recognise that all choices have risks, for example, coal ash, of which we produce large quantities, contains uranium and is low level radioactive waste. If we assume that, then I think it makes sense to keep nuclear as part of the mix. I have argued already that we need nuclear if CCS does not prove feasible. This is why I've put in a combined figure of at least 40 gigawatts on the previous slide, that one, for both clean coal and or nuclear, to cover that. There are further questions about tide and wave, because they are a long way from being proven technologies. Wood and biofuels require huge areas of land. Wood, 18% of UK agricultural land. Biofuels, 12% of UK land. On that map, the light green is biofuels and the dark green is wood. This is Mackay showing the sort of amount of land that might take. So, to conclude, many of the technologies are new and untested. Nuclear is tried and tested. I suggest that it would be rash to ditch it. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sean? Sean? Go for it now.
Now, do you know what to press?
Just bottom one for the atmosphere. Okay.
Well, good evening. My name's Sean Morris. I'm UK and Ireland Secretary of the Nuclear Free Local Authorities, and I'm just going to give you a few pointers on the other side of the argument, really. Just give you a very brief overview of what the organisation is that I represent. And then the way I've done my presentation is give you a sort of a number of what I consider nuclear myths, really, around climate change, energy security, the economics, waste, safety, health, and also a little bit about the weapons issue as well. And then I'm going to go into briefly, really, what we see as the better way forward, which is a renewable future linked with a local energy revolution as well, and then try to answer the question about whether it's nuclear-free or nuclear is the best way forward. Very briefly then, who are the NFLA? We started in 1980 when the Cold War was at its height, started very much around the nuclear weapons issue, but with the Chernobyl disaster we moved very much onto the nuclear power agenda. And we see ourselves really as a little bit of a nuclear watchdog in that sense, really. Got members across the British Isles, campaign on the nuclear power and nuclear weapons issues, and we're a cross-party group. We're not one party, we have 11 political parties represented on our organisation, as well as independents. So I'm not giving you a single party line here as well. It's done by consensus, what we agree with, really. Work very closely with the industry and debate with the industry, but also with government and with lots of NGOs as well. And there's our website if you want to look a bit more about what we do. So just to go into some of the what I might class as the myths, really. The first one is around climate change. And I think the first thing I'd like to just reiterate is we don't really need nuclear. Renewables are unlimited, as was mentioned in the first presentation. They're free, in that sense. They're available everywhere. And I do think, and I'll elaborate on it later, they're much safer, really. Nuclear also needs raw material. It needs a fossil fuel, uranium. There's lots of work around extraction. And also there's big issues around long-term availability. Just like with oil, it's a finite material, really. And after the sort of, within the sort of next sort of 30 years, when the largest part of your easy mined uranium is there, then we're getting into the, it's much more difficult to extract, and problems with availability, really, and finding it as well, really. So that's another part of it, really. But can nuclear, though, be part of that 30% green energy, the low-carbon energy, to mitigate climate change? Well, really, you should look at it in one respect. Electricity, as I've mentioned in the very first presentation, is around about 18% of UK energy demand, and most of that is in transport and heating. Of our electricity, nuclear power is 14.4% currently of electricity generation in the UK. But with losses at the power stations, in the transmission network and so on, this reduces to around 5.3% of total energy. So replacing nuclear, the nuclear power stations that are on tap at the moment, will just save around 5.3% of the carbon dioxide emissions, unless there's a huge push for nuclear. So we're well away from that 30% figure that is mentioned there, really, as well. Also, the other aspect of climate change, which is not get mentioned on my slide, is most of the nuclear power stations around the coast. One of the aspects of climate change is huge increase in sea levels, and one of the concerns is how will you be able to protect those sites as well, particularly if we get the sort of sea level rises that are predicted. Now, linking into that first slide, this is a slide from a source of Jan Willem Stoltenberg, who was a member of the Intergovernmental Climate Change Panel. And that's looking at nuclear wind in terms of the issues of uranium extraction, really. Again, it's high grade, there's lots of chemicals needed in terms of extracting the uranium and in processing the uranium and in mining the uranium as well. So it's a much higher carbon dioxide emission from the uranium part of it. It's not in the nuclear generation part of it, but in getting the uranium for it, really. And that's often forgotten about in this debate, really. It also doesn't include the carbon emissions, dioxide emissions from waste transportation, storage of waste, decommission issues, and the whole aspects around security as well. Secondly then, we'll look at energy security and sort of does nuclear generate better energy security, as is often suggested. Well, we already have a long-term secure energy deal for gas with Norway, a secure, sensitive, sensible country, not likely to have political turmoil like some of the other countries we may deal with, really. I also want to look at the other aspects of what France did. France is a very high nuclear using country, and it went for the nuclear option in 1973 largely to make itself more fossil free dependent. But according to the EU average, it's more oil dependent than most, really. So is it that much securer if there's problems then with energy, with oil, as there will be over the next few decades? And what we would suggest is it's the idea of centralised against decentralised energy. A study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology suggests that the centralised energy market, which is what nuclear relies on, eats up energy and it increases fossil fuel usage, really. Whereas a decentralised energy system, and the study that's been done for London and Edinburgh city councils, shows that if you use a decentralised renewable system, you can reduce gas consumption by 15% over 20 years. But the other thing, and David Cameron made this point actually last week in the debates, the crunch time is 2015. By that point, we haven't got any new nuclear power stations on tap, because they won't be built at the very earliest 2017. So what we would suggest is that gas and energy efficiency are the only options in the short term, and that, from that point of view, energy security is an issue further down the line, really. So in terms of the economics then, whether nuclear power is cheaper and provides more jobs, well, a new nuclear power station could cost anywhere between 12 and 20 billion, and one of the aspects of nuclear power generally is it always costs much more than it's actually said at the beginning, really. The respected bank, Citibank, has said that can't be done in this country unless there's a huge public subsidy. So far, both Labour and the Conservatives have said they would not give such a subsidy. There may be ways to go around it through increased electricity bills, but where's the money in that sense going to come from, really? And look at the examples that are around at the moment. Well, the main one at the moment being built in Europe is in Finland. That nuclear power station is already 3 billion over its original budget. There's been over 1,000 safety flaws found in it as well, and it's 3 years already behind its original start time as well. So that's the sort of problems that we could get here with a new suite of nuclear power station. That's what we've had in the past with Sizewell and so on as well. Linked to that is also the cost of the radioactive waste legacy, which I will push on further, really. But the NDA, Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, says that estimates it around 80 billion as well. Yes, there will be some jobs from new nuclear build, but also one of our big concerns is there's a major nuclear legacy to sort out, decommissioning the existing stations, dealing with the waste as well. Will all the new jobs be going into new build against that, and what's the issues around safety for that as well? The government itself has also suggested there are thousands of new jobs available in renewable energy, and a report by Greenpeace and the European Renewable Energy Centre suggests that you can get seven times more jobs from the renewable sector than you can with nuclear as well. And also, within all this, we're in the biggest recession in history. How can we spend on nuclear, renewable and energy efficiency at the same time? We've got to make some hard decisions, and trying to do it for everyone possibly risks the problem of not doing enough, because we're not spending enough on each one of them, really. Okay. Just to briefly go on then, and the key points, really. Well, one of the biggest problems for nuclear is the waste issue. After 50 years, we haven't resolved it. There's no guarantee that we'll still be able to, a repository in Cumbria. It's still very conditional, and even when it's done, it's another 40 years before it's built, really. We have problems currently with low-level waste, and now we're even considering going to landfill. But those new nuclear power stations being built will be having waste on their sites for 160 years, at least, really. Much more dangerous high burn waste as well. So we're actually creating a problem which our great-grandchildren and beyond is going to have to deal with. Is that something we should be considering at the moment, really? And then linked to that is health, really. And I want to just mention this German government study, which was done by the to try to dispel some of the health risk, really. That suggested that there is a 2.2 times increase in child leukaemia and a 1.6 times increase in child solid cancers if you live within 5 kilometres of a nuclear power station. And they suggest in that study that there's a strong link, therefore, to living near the reactors. That study has been accepted by the German government and it's now being considered by the UK government. But they're not yet going to report till June, when we may have made a decision after the election next week. And with safety, the designs for the two possible power stations, both have been questioned by the Nuclear Installation Inspectorate, and there have been leaked documents for EDF suggesting that the EPR design is susceptible to a Chernobyl-type disaster. We regularly follow up leaks and so on. Just last week, Sellafield put 5 radioactive waste bags in a landfill site because the scanners didn't work. Regularly there are safety lapses, and it's humanity makes mistakes as well, really. There's lots of concerns around transport increasing as well. And last week, a couple of weeks ago, we've also got the real concerns around nuclear terrorism. So linking into that is around nuclear proliferation. We still have lots of bombs in our nuclear bombs in our world. and the widespread promotion of nuclear power around the world, which has been suggested. Gordon Brown suggests 1,000 nuclear power stations. Means, you know, the link is there. Pakistan, India, Iran, and so on, and so on. Just got one more slide. Okay. So what we suggest is a renewable future. This is a suggested view of Price Waterhouse's. A mix of the renewables, as mentioned on the slide, and a local energy revolution. Give the example of Kirklees. If you do lots of work on that area, you can make a difference, really.
Okay.
And so that is our conclusions, really.
Thank you.
Renewable energy mix.
Thank you. With fairness, you'll have a couple extra minutes, Russell.
Right, good evening. My major topic is to talk about the waste side of this, but I do actually want to address one or two other points before I really start. It is not technically possible for the EPR to undergo the same sort of disaster as Chernobyl, simply because of the completely different nature of the reactor design. And in fact, one of the problems with Chernobyl, apart from the fundamental flaw in the reactor design, which the reactors of the West don't suffer from, was the fact there was no containment building. Three Mile Island in the United States, which was a few years before Chernobyl, they destroyed the reactor comprehensively. But because of the containment building, there was virtually zero release of radioactivity to the environment. Making mistakes does not necessarily mean that you have another Chernobyl, if you get your design right in the first place. And I would suggest in the West that we have got the basic designs right. Okay. Having hit that particular point, why are we interested in nuclear at all? Well, fundamentally, it is because we're actually utilising the binding energy of the nucleus. And there's much more energy tied up in that than there is in any chemical reaction. If you actually try and compare the amount of electricity that can be produced by 1 ton of natural uranium to 1 ton of coal, you get a factor of the order of 17,000 times difference. Nuclear can produce a lot more energy simply because we are utilising that binding energy of the nucleus. But, of course, it does produce waste. Everything we do produces waste. CO2 from burning fossil fuels is a waste. Clearly, the radioactive waste from a nuclear reactor is a challenge. It's not something that we can afford to ignore. But we produce all sorts of waste that pose different challenges, and to a greater or lesser extent, we deal with them appropriately. The one that we have failed to deal with appropriately so far is CO2. And that is why we've got climate change. So what I want to say a little bit about is the technologies that we have for dealing with the nuclear waste. What I do have on this particular slide is a graph that shows relative annual amounts of toxic waste. So this is non-nuclear. Low-level nuclear waste, intermediate-level nuclear waste, and high-level nuclear waste. And I'll define those slightly more clearly in a minute. I do have to point out, of course, that is a logarithmic scale, because otherwise the high-level nuclear waste would effectively disappear off that graph completely. But essentially, the volumes, particularly of the really hazardous nuclear waste, are relatively small compared to many of the other wastes we produce. And that particular picture on the first slide is a classic sort of nuclear industry publicity shot, if you like, but that essentially is the volume of vitrified high-level waste that would correspond to the amount that would be generated, produced by the electricity required by one person in their lifetime. So, yes, if you multiply that by the total population, the volume's going to go up quite markedly, but on the other hand, compared to many of the other wastes we produce, the volumes are low. Now, wastes are classified, or nuclear wastes are classified into very low-level waste, which effectively is not considered to be radioactive. What the industry is concerned with are these other categories, the low-level waste, intermediate-level waste, and high-level waste. It is worth pointing out that whether or not we build any more nuclear reactors, we will still go on producing some radioactive waste, and not simply from the existing nuclear program, but from things like the medical program. They may be largely categorised as low-level waste, but we will still produce them because we use radioisotopes in other areas. Now, admittedly, the waste that we are perhaps most concerned with from the nuclear cycle are the high-level wastes. These are self-heating waste due to radioactive decay. And in the UK, they primarily at the moment effectively arise from recycling the nuclear fuel and effectively separating out the reusable uranium and plutonium. Now, there is an argument to be had as to whether that is an appropriate technology to continue. If you don't go down that route, instead what you have is spent nuclear fuel, which effectively is its own category of high-level waste. So, these wastes originate from various parts of the cycle. They're contaminated materials from just handling nuclear materials at various parts of the nuclear fuel cycle, but also from other areas, relatively small amounts from there, but they do exist. The primary end is from nuclear fuel, because basically, when we, quote, burn nuclear fuel in the reactor, and it's perhaps a slightly unfortunate term to use, but it is the one that is used. Essentially, what we're doing is fissioning uranium-235. And when we fission uranium-235, it splits into two roughly equal-sized parts, giving a very wide range of chemical elements. In fact, you can end up with the better part of a third of the periodic table appearing in your fuel. Some of those fission products that you produce, unfortunately, make the subsequent nuclear reactions less efficient because they capture neutrons, and the neutrons are important for maintaining the nuclear fission process. Other things start to damage the physical structure of the fuel, and eventually it gets to the point that you have to remove the fuel from the reactor, and it is then placed in a cooling pond. And this picture is actually a picture of the cooling pond at Thorpe at Sellafield. And as I've already said, in the UK we then currently, not with all our fuel, but with a good fraction of it, reprocess that fuel to recover reusable uranium and plutonium, and the reusable uranium and plutonium can go to produce a mixed oxide fuel that can then go back into the reactor. Now that process does lead to a high level liquid waste. And that is the stuff that we vitrify in the UK. As I say, other programs don't do that. In the US, for example, Sweden, they just store the spent nuclear fuel, and that is what they're talking about long-term disposal. Now, one thing to point out about nuclear waste is it does eventually, and it is eventually, decay. The very thing that we're worried about, the radioactivity, arises because nuclei are splitting, are decaying into other species, and eventually that decays down to levels that start approaching the level of the original ore. So this is a calculation for spent nuclear fuel compared to uranium ore. So this is the radioactivity of the uranium ore along here, and you can see eventually, and it is on a long time scale, we get back down to that sort of level. It doesn't mean that the materials completely without hazard at that point. It simply means that over time it becomes less hazardous. And a certain degree of the radioactivity disappears really relatively quickly. Okay. Right. The intermediate low-level stuff in the UK is placed in cement. The high-level, more hazardous waste is vitrified. The point about vitrification is the waste is chemically bonded into the glass matrix. And it actually becomes fundamentally part of the glass. I'll skip to here for a moment. And essentially, if you do durability experiments on the glass, what you can show is there is initially a point where you can remove things from the glass fairly quickly, but then you get to very low rates of removal. And one of the long-term arguments for this sort of waste form is that if it is disposed of at depth, and we will normally be talking about placing it probably of the order of half a kilometre underground, although there is an argument for going much deeper with deep borehole disposal. We place it in this sort of repository at about half a kilometre down. It is then surrounded by a canister before it goes in there. That is then surrounded by a backfill bentonite. This is a sort of model experiment that's being conducted in Switzerland with a model canister, not actual, it doesn't have real waste in it. There is then an engineering of the repository walls around that. And then there's half a kilometre of rock. And those combined barriers are designed to ensure that the radioactivity does not come back to the biosphere.
1 minute.
We can have some confidence in the rock. There are some natural analogues. Perhaps the best example is the Oklo Natural Reactor, where some uranium deposits effectively acted as a natural reactor about 1.7 billion years ago. From analysis of what's there, it's reckoned that the plutonium that was formed has moved about 3 metres in 1.7 billion years. So, overall, I haven't really addressed the point that nuclear power provides low carbon baseload electricity, but it does. And I would argue that we do have technologies and solutions for the safe handling and ultimate disposal of radioactive waste. The big problem is the political will, or the lack of, for developing a repository. It has suited the green agenda to say we can't build a repository, we can find all sorts of reasons for not doing so. The objections are political, they are not technical. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you everybody for coming here this evening. I've got you now for 10 minutes to take you through. 20 years now I've been working on sustainable development. My background is one of assessing the sustainability of energy sources when compared to urban development. The question in my mind is not can we do it, but the question is should we do it? That is the key item that we need to define, and something that we will talk about. So I intend to head through both of those that already stolen my fire, quite literally. 2 billion years ago, natural reactor, uranium and fission is not an unnatural process. As a scientist, you can't be defining things as just being bad or good. This isn't how it is. It turns out that there is a massive amount of uranium in the centre of our planet. Latest theory is that this is what protects us from some of the nastiest emissions. Although the sun is, without a doubt, the final solution to our energy, it does put out some very nasty electromagnetic energy as well. And without nuclear fission, we'd have a problem. In addition to which, it is one of the reasons why we have a living Earth. It is one of the things that keeps us warm, recycles our minerals, recycles our carbon, and is the reason that we're one of the reasons that we've got solid rock below us in terms of that process of geomorphology. So I felt I just kind of had to set the scene. But really, what I intend to talk about today is: can we deliver it? Is it safe? How much fuel is there? Does low carbon mean sustainable? I think all of us are starting to question this. Too often the two are used without any thought about what that means. And is there such thing as a necessary evil, a requirement, a stopgap, whatever you wish to use this? And can this technology fix this? Finally, I think an analysis of who's in favour and why is a very interesting one.
So, quick overview, we've had it said to us, so I'm not going to dwell on this. Nuclear fission nuclear reactor. It's one of these. It's a steam engine. It's bloody complicated, let me tell you. But that's all it is. 350-year-old technology. And if engineers can't deliver a safe version of that, well, you know, it's time to take them out and shoot them. actually, the technology itself is about 1,900 years old. You know, so we've got a long history of this. In fact, some people would call steam engines archaic, potentially. The other element of this is nuclear waste. So, it's beautiful, isn't it? Shame it's kind of scary as well. We've got some very clever ways of holding on to this, keeping it stable. We've just had a very interesting concept of this vitrification. But the question here is, you know, we saw 10 to the 3. That's 10,000 years, if I'm not mistaken. 10,000 years, we've got to hang on to this. To be confident. In the data, there is as much as 1 million years we need to hang on to this. Can we do that? Are humans capable of building structures with that kind of lifespan? Well, here's the oldest structure that we've found so far, 500,000 years old, perhaps pushing it a little bit. This is a little more sensible. It's the oldest above-ground structure on the planet. It's 11,000 years. Interesting. Just into that 10,000-year requirement there, Turkey. And again, if our architects could build something 11,000 years ago that would still be standing now, perhaps it is within the capability of humanity to do it again. Again, we can do it, but should we do it? Because there is this issue of safety. Both of these have been mentioned, and it should be noted that the part that failed in both of them was the same. As it was pointed out to me earlier, it was the human element. And there is no doubt that the human element will be involved in any reactor that is to be built in the foreseeable future. I thought it was interesting to include a statement by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this is the front page of their website. It turns out that there have only been 2 significant events. Excellent, there you go. However, I was looking at the latest publication on nuclear safety, and it turns out that in 2008, there were 140 safety-related events. Not sure what that means. Maybe somebody could explain that to me afterwards. But it's okay. Most of them had no safety significance. So don't worry. We're on that. I know I'm saying that with my tongue firmly in my cheek. However, there is an organisation that has, in the 70 years that it's been running nuclear reactors, never had an accident, ever. This one, 140, that's one every other day of a working week. That's quite interesting. But there is one organisation that's never had one. It happens to be the United States Navy. Never. I can't help but put this one on, the latest addition to the nuclear fleet. Now, let's hope that the name has no effect on its performance. But there's a question there. There's an interesting development of why. Why? Why is that? Well, who's using these reactors? They're highly trained, disciplined. Their primary goal is delivery of reliable energy. Their effectiveness is measured not on profitability, but on being there in a fight. And as such, they are top flight, quite literally. Now, I think we need to reflect that with the nuclear power industry. What drives the nuclear power industry? Not the reactors, but the industry. And I think this list is not unreasonable. Profit, meeting regulations at minimum cost, efficiencies of scale, and jobs and economic security. Okay, let's now talk very briefly about the availability of the fuel. Can't make any more. Well, theoretically, I suppose you could with a massive particle accelerator. We're not going there. The sun that birthed our solar system created pretty much all the uranium we're ever going to have. Amazingly, it's quite ubiquitous across our planet. In the sea, in the granite, sedimentary rock, continental crust, it's bloody everywhere. The economically viable stuff, by the IEA again, says that we've got around an 80-year resource base at current consumption levels. Me, I'm going to say, let's play this safe. because we're really good at finding stuff. Look at the oil thing. Let's double that, okay? Let's say it's 160 years. But let's also put into the equation the expansion of the nuclear power industry, which is approximately 2.6, if you want to be here, and see what that does to the lifetime. Well, that brings us down to 53 years. Now, we're all aware of this concept of peak oil, or you may not be, I don't have time to go through it. But economically, when we get halfway through a mineral, it gets very, very uncomfortable. And that, of course, puts our peak uranium figure at somewhere between 30 and 50 years of now. I know I've made some huge assumptions, but I don't think I've been completely unreasonable there. And then there's this issue of sustainability. The Sustainable Development Commission says that for every gigawatt produced, it produces about 4.4 tonnes of carbon. Just to give you an idea, carbon sustainability, which it says is roughly the same as offshore wind. By looking at another reference, actually, Australian University, again, no axe to grind on that. That, interestingly, so the bold is Sustainable Development Commission, the non-bold is not. Turns out that there's quite a band. And again, we come into my reference is better than your reference kind of argument, which, you know, it is unknown. Clearly, it's better than coal and gas, but really, we have to be very careful when a government, thank you, comes out with this. And, of course, nuclear power has this situation that it's birth to death. You know, we put it in there and we look after it for 10,000 years and hopefully it becomes benign enough so that it's not dangerous. Excellent. However, that isn't the future. The future is birth to birth. We must look to a recyclable nature to all of our systems if we're going to have 9 to 20 billion people in the next 150 years, which is a look at the data. It's possible.
Not enough trees to keep the rain.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there's a massive debate there. Okay. So, to sum up, lifespan, 30 years, peak, very difficult to recycle. Concentrated energy source has different economic factors. Concentralized energy, very poor in dealing with fuel poverty. Private companies will always seek to maximize price of energy. That's what they do. And it's almost impossible to U-turn an agenda once it starts because it's too big to fail. And there is this relatively low but high-skilled employment base associated with it. There is a wider employment base, but that's the same with any industry. So, what do we do? Energy efficiency can halve us. If we commit with the kind of commitment that we did at World War II, we can have within 2040 sustainable delivery of housing and lifestyle. But yes, it is a challenge. But if we start saying if something's really difficult, we don't do it, then we miss out on the greatest opportunity that our society has offered us since we started breaking ground to grow crops. That this is what we're playing around with now if we head down the wrong pathway. This is not something that we can just decide, oh no, okay, we'll change again. And I'm guessing...
1 minute.
Okay, right. Last thing, I'm a bit contentious here, please don't throw anything. Engineers, people who are in favour, engineers, why? Because they love it, don't they? We design them to solve problems. You give them a big problem and they just love it. So you can't trust them to make the decision, should we do it? You can trust them to solve a problem, but you can't trust their decision-making process. Secondly, employers of the nuclear industry, of course, it's a great job, well paid. You know, why not? Why wouldn't you be interested? Shareholders, anybody in there who's looking for a stable economic return? You can look find it very difficult to find a more stable return than investing in the nuclear industry. And then, of course, there are people who see 30 to 50 years as being beyond their concern. You know, if that's how you live, and there are plenty of people like that, then nuclear power's for you. Absolutely. Why wouldn't you? It's a great solution. And then finally, of course, any decision that makes a fix before the next election, of course, is a great solution to many, many politicians. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just to remind you how we're going to... Thank you very much. Just to remind you how we're going to proceed. There were a number of pre-submitted questions that we're going to address.
And then, but we have a very short period of time, and then there'll be questions as well from the audience. And then there'll be also a time, hopefully, of a few minutes of summing up by the panel. Just to remind you, then I'll be asking you the questions again. Okay? Now, just remember now, at the table, you pick up the things that are there, so, and also decide if you want any of these presentations. There's also a card there that is addressed there. And it's a card. You pick one up, and hopefully you'll carry it on to what it's meant to be. Okay, if there's not any further ado, then we're going to start off with... is Chris Jones here? Okay. Your question... Do you want to try to state it from here? You don't mind? Okay, let me get this... John, did you turn it off, or...?
Did you want me to turn it up? I thought it was...
No, I just want to put the question up on the...
God.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, just press the blank on the screen.
Sorry, I didn't want our presentation just sort of sitting there.
No, that's okay. Okay, so let me... Yes, how low carbon is... nuclear generation when considering uranium extraction and refinement processes and carbon waste through the power station. Now, one of the members will decide to answer that, and I'll carry on to control their passion. So which member wants to answer that? Yes.
I'll boom. I'll start a new forum. The answer from the energy industry is a reassuring... We're not sure. It's somewhere between 5 grams and 130 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour. 5 to 130. Coal is 990. Gas is 550. The Committee on Climate Change say we need to get our grid down to below 50. So the answer from our energy experts is between 5 and 130 is informative, but doesn't actually help us resolve that question. I have no idea how to...
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
But I was assuming you could hear me before. The meta-analyses of the studies have said... Some say it's 5 grams, some say it's up to 130 grams. The answer seems to be halfway. But all that tells us is it's 65 grams plus or minus 60 grams. And again, that doesn't leave us a lot the wiser.
The only thing to sort of add to that is there are sort of obvious extremes. The Storm Smith report was mentioned earlier, because that's anti, that tends to come out with a high figure. The nuclear industry tends to come out with a low figure. I have actually had a student look at calculations as a sort of desktop study, and lo and behold, he came out somewhere between the two, at least on the uranium extraction side. There will obviously ultimately be an issue about going to lower grade ores, because they will require more energy to extract them. So there will be a limited lifespan, simply because we're dealing with a finite resource.
Okay. Now, does anyone from the audience have any question related to this question, or I'll carry on to the next one? Yes, sir? Please state your name.
There's been no comparison made with the cost for wind power or water power, for example, for their carbon production and their manufacture and disposal and servicing maintenance.
Does anyone remember what you're...
Because these are also non-CO2, aren't they?
I did. There was the Sustainable Development Commission said that it was 4.4, roughly the same, but variations dropped that down to 1.6, up to 4.4 being interestingly some of the highest figures. Which you know, it's interesting that the 4.4 figure for nuclear from the Sustainable Development Commission seems to be in the middle. But the figure that they chose for offshore wind seems to be the high end of the carbon production on that. I'm not sure if that was done on purpose, but you know, there's a question there. Roughly the same.
It does matter where you make them. If you have a wind turbine made in Denmark, you'll get about 5 to 7 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour.
That's compared to our target of 50. So that's well under the target. Oh. If you make it in China and it's powered by coal, things get a factor of 100, maybe 50 worse.
Well, we're going to go on to the next one. Bev Cross, are you here?
Unrelated to that question. What? A quick question.
No, we don't have time, that's it. We're very...
If we have time at the end, we'll come back to you.
Yeah, we'll come back to it. Okay. Bev Cross, the question we're going to ask you... Yes. How does the pro-nuclear... Would you like to say it, Bev?
Well, I'm going to have a pro-nuclear guarantee of long-term safe storage in taking account of possible terrorism, earthquakes, that sort of thing.
Quite simply, that is why we need to build a repository. If you insist on keeping this stuff above ground long term, then you are going to have more problems. Rock can do an awful lot for you.
The one thing that needs to be mentioned though is that nowhere in the world yet have we actually built one. You know, the Americans have just decided after, with Obama's election, that they're not going to do Yucca Mountain. The Swedes are beginning to get worried now. And even though Cumbria has put themselves tentatively forward for a UK one, there's a lot of conditionality to that. Corum, the Committee on Radioactive Waste Management, are very concerned about problems around that. And the other aspect is about, can you retrieve it if there's a problem? What happens if you have a terrorist attack, things like that. There are big issues with it as well, and that's why, you know, yes, it is a political issue as well as a technical issue, but politicians have got to be sensitive to what you wish as well, and public acceptability is one of the biggest problems with this as well.
I have to quickly mention this, the point that was made earlier in the presentation, that the 3 metres in 1.6 billion years, obviously that's a truism, because you found it 2 million years after it happened. So the proof that it can be only 3 metres in 1.6 billion years doesn't necessarily mean that that's how fast material moves through rock. It just is the proof that it happened with that one. And I think that's important to clarify that.
I'm happy for you to say something about rock.
Yeah.
If you want to say something about rock.
I would accept that point. But the point is that you would choose a geology that's going to give you a similar sort of performance.
I just thought it was a kind of a throwaway statement originally that needed clarifying.
All right then, boys? Yes. Okay, now, in relation to the audience, are there any questions from the audience related to this question?
This is a point of information.
Go ahead.
Just a point of information, which probably relates to all the questions. Are your presentations, which were all interesting and full of figures that we can't possibly cram into our little brains, are they going to be available?
Yeah, I've already said that. They are. Yeah. Okay. So
we don't need to remember all these things.
That's right. No, we said at the beginning, and I'll remind people, when you finish, there's a registration sheet. Your name is there, or it's not there. It depends on whether you're concerned about being deported or not. And then, just state whether you want the four of the presentations are there. You can look at them, and then you can decide which one you want. If you want all four, they can be sent to you electronically. But if you want them by post, then you'll have to put a few pence in my pocket. Okay, thank you. Okay, next person.
Just a very quick point about safety in general. NFLA
quoted Go ahead.
That there were clusters of leukemia and solid cancers in the regions of nuclear power plants. But actually, medical studies which I read after that first was quoted suggest that that's more related to the sudden influx of a large number of foreign people into a relatively stable community, and viruses can be associated with both leukemias and solid cancers, we know that. And you can prove that that happens in any site where you've built major industry and you've had an influx of employees into a stable community to service that.
Thank you. Does anyone want... Could any one of you describe that? No? That's fine. Okay, now...
Just one that actually... Germany.
Pardon?
Germany are actually reconsidering at the moment whether they should extend the life of their nuclear reactors. And also, in their debates, they're looking at whether they should, you know, start building nuclear reactors again. So it's an interesting thing that, you know, the Germans are actually looking at the nuclear question again.
Okay, thank you. Ralph, are they? The family, Ralph? Okay, you have a question. Let me just see if I can be able to find it. Here we go. Would you like to state your question?
I think it's straightforward enough.
Okay. So
you have to, if you're going to have even a 50-year use, and that's about as much as you're going to get according to most of what we're doing, you still have to decide what level of disaster you're prepared to tolerate during that period.
Okay. Would anybody like to, the panel would like to answer that? Russell?
It obviously depends on your view about nuclear power. Some people would say any reactor is going to run the same sort of risk as Chernobyl. I think anybody technical in the industry would say quite categorically we don't face that sort of risk with nuclear power. Once we remove some of the old Soviet reactors, and there are some of those still there, and they are potentially an issue, then we don't face a risk on that scale. What we face the risk of at the moment is global climate change, and the potential dangers of that are many, many times Chernobyl. Of a different type, yes, but one of the interesting things about the Chernobyl site, or the place, the surrounding area, yes, it's contaminated now, and nobody would want to go and live there. But because there aren't any humans, large animals have returned.
The question is,
if you want to say something, please raise your hand. Okay. But, John, go ahead, then I'll come back to you.
Okay,
go ahead.
John?
Right, acceptable catastrophes. You might argue that nuclear power is a lot safer. But this idea that nuclear power saves a greater catastrophe, such as climate change, is a false argument in that hopefully people have picked up there are much better solutions. If it's climate change or fuel poverty or high energy costs or any of these, that is a catastrophe as well. That nuclear can answer but should not be the first choice in that one.
Thank you. Linda and then Richard, and then we'll go back to the next question.
Just going to say to answer the question directly, zero.
Okay. Richard, do you want to make a statement? Then we'll have to move on, because I have to give myself a five-minute warning.
Can I just add one point? There is a second sort of phase to that question, which talks about allowing energy use into the indefinite future at current or higher levels. That is a key question. Should we be doing that?
Does anyone here want to answer that before we go to Richard?
I'm only interested in nuclear as a very short-term stopgap. I would be very unhappy myself if there's any nuclear. We would be building any nuclear stations in 40 years' time.
Okay, John,
but it is catastrophic to commit the resources to build nuclear reactors to meet that 40-year challenge. Because we do not have a limitless sized cup. You know, we have to make the right decision now, not a decision that will offset a problem 4 years' time, because all you're doing is deferring that problem to 40 years in the future. You're not, we might not be able to meet that challenge.
Okay. Richard, you want to make a statement, and then we'll move on to the next question. Sorry to be so rushed, but we only have a limited time.
Did you know that Chernobyl has just been converted into a sort of entertainment park? To be honest, I just think it's unbelievably sick-minded.
Okay, thank you. Now, next question. Ian Wallace. You want to state it, is that fine, Ian?
You tell me.
Okay, why aren't Forge Best or Sheffield building tide power machines instead of nuclear? Okay, so Malcolm is going to start that answer, and then go ahead, Malcolm.
Forge Masters, are building or can build subsea equipment. So they're just two examples. They're doing a whole range of equipment. They're doing hydro plant for China, for India. They're doing a massive amount of alternatives other than nuclear. But I don't know whether, do you want to mention the bottleneck that in nuclear, John, Professor Atkinson, with regard to we will have nuclear provision from other countries, and there's going to be a need for manufacturers, and you know, maybe John can tell us about the engineering.
I think at the present time, Sheffield Forgemasters have seen a commercial opening. Yes. They've had about £80 million investment earmarked by the Mandelson to build larger forges and so on to make larger components. The reason behind this is at the moment the whole of the nuclear industry has to buy their forges from one supplier in Japan called Japan Steelworks. They're the only people who can handle 500 ton ingots and very large, approximately 1 foot or 300 millimeter thick forging. So that's why there's a commercial opportunity. I guess in the offshore area or the type of energy that you were talking about, there aren't sufficient commercial opportunities yet to make a profit. So Forgemasters want to do it to secure their commercial future, and they form partnerships with Westinghouse and some large companies who have a large number of orders in China, India. So it's a whole commercial thing that's slowly building, and it will benefit Sheffield through that link, whether you like it or not. Because China will go ahead and India will go ahead. In the Times it mentioned 500 new reactors in India and 300 in China. Very large numbers of reactors.
Good, thank you. There's, if you mind, I'll just go to the audience at the moment. Anyone else from the audience want to say something related to that?
Yeah.
Yes? Julie, you haven't spoken, then I'll come back to you. It's rather good. I'm sorry you have to run down, but come on. You need the exercise.
I feel like Jeremy Connell.
Okay.
I'll shout, that's all right.
How did you feel when EDF cheated on you with your brother?
Did everyone hear that?
I mean, the other kind of answer to it is just political will and political choice, or you might say Richard Caborn.
Yes.
Very good.
Thank you. Now you have to go back up.
Mine was just a layperson's answer. Is presumably because nobody's asked them to do tidal power machines, whereas people have asked them to do nuclear.
Yes.
And they're just responding to a commercial demand, like any commercial company.
Thank you.
And you can't blame them for that.
Okay. Is anybody from the panel want to...
Politicians, though.
Pardon?
You blame the politicians.
Okay. It's my father always said that. Okay. Okay, anyone from the panel would like to say something? Yes, Russell?
Obviously, there are commercial demands and things. I, for one, would be quite happy to do away with all sorts of aspects of our economic system, but unfortunately, it's what we currently live with. And if we can find a way of changing it, I would be very happy to support you. But we have to manage to do that without causing a revolution,
effectively. Excuse me?
And killing lots of people, because revolutions do. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Now, have a short talk there.
Okay, thank you. Now, I have a quick question for you prior to the questions that follow. I could give a bit extra time now and not rush it as much for the next 10 minutes. Is that fine with everyone?
Yeah.
Okay, just wanted to check it out with you because I don't want to overextend your time and tell you what your time is coming because the pub's closed. You know. Okay, now Rick Morgan, are you here? Okay, Rick Morgan.
Thank you.
So, would you like to state it, Rick, or just have people read it?
You can state it,
Jack. Myself, all right. What would you have to see for your opinion to change? That is, if you are not in favor of nuclear power, what would you have to see for you to be willing to support its use in electricity generation? Or, if you currently support its use in electricity generation, what would you change? How would you change your mind? So would the panel members like to... the microphone's here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What would change my mind was if there was a sudden change in the extent of political will. If we are going to not have nuclear power, what it demands is a rapid drop in demand. And I think there's some very clear solutions here. One is if, in fact, the Green New Deal really kicked in. And I would be looking for a government, which would almost certainly have to be some sort of cross-party government, I think. We may be able to have that. Which would really grasp things and be prepared to go hell for leather and do things across a whole range of things. For example, immediately going for the change of summertime in time, having a reduction of 50 miles an hour for the speed limit, really going absolutely flat out on the insulation of houses, dealing with the problem of the solid wall houses and how to deal with solid wall houses in conservation areas. All entirely possible. And I'd also be looking for things like the ways in which it's possible to, the Lib Dem idea, reduce the, so the electricity, instead of being, if you pay more, if you use more, you pay less if you use more, reverse it. To have something whereby, in fact, cars, instead of you paying, to have a much heavier duty for more consuming cars, and instead of paying a lot up front, you pay for the amount you travel. And so I'd be looking for a whole range of things which really engage people. For example, wind farms face huge problems. But if in fact you made it so that wind farms were owned by local people and the money that was made for them, made by them, actually profited local people, it might change the people of the Isle of Lewis who would think that they really would enjoy having an enormous wind farm there, which would be disruptive, but on the other hand, they get some money. So that's the sort of thing which would make me change. If we got a government which really was prepared to say, we are prepared to do things in the way and on the scale that's demanded. And I hope that happens.
Thank you.
I think it's difficult for me to see what the benefits of nuclear are, really. So I can't change my mind, you'd have to make it safe. There's many examples when it hasn't happened and where it's been unsafe. The waste is an imponderable. I mean, we've had 60 years of nuclear power now and we're still nowhere near a solution. Until I see something a bit more sensible on that front, I'll remain a sceptic in that way.
Well, you
could
try to get out to the US Navy.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm quite happy.
Just Nick John's answer.
I don't have any inroads into the US Navy, sorry.
Go ahead. But the simple fact is wind, well, any renewable energies, there's no potential for them to kill you. There is with this, and that's my biggest concern always, really.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? John? And then we'll go to the...
Please.
Oh, okay, can I just go to the audience and come back to you?
All right.
Okay. Is that okay? Good. Okay. Yes?
You said that there's no potential for renewable energy to kill people.
Pardon?
You said that there's no potential for renewable energy to kill people.
Yes.
But there's instances where hydroelectric dams have killed thousands of people. Like in the late 1970s, there's one in India that killed less than 10,000 people in the bus. So him saying that renewable energy is not safe is a bit of a lunch.
Yo.
Has anyone heard that? What he's saying is that there have been people who have died in relation to hydroelectric dams.
And building wind turbines.
And mining coal. And there have been accidents here in Sheffield and the blades fell off.
A dam.
Oh, that's a dam. Okay. Go ahead, Russell. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay, then we'll get back to the audience and Russell will say something.
I think what would have to change my mind, or would be required to change my mind, is actually addressing one of the big elephants in the room about our whole role on this planet.
and that is dealing with the population problem.
Okay, Malcolm will say something then to Jan. Unless you weren't now, Jan, it's okay. Go ahead, Jan.
It was pretty simple. A 12 degree atmospheric temperature rise. Catastrophic climate change. Catastrophic climate change, or fundamentally the landing of an enormous rock on our planet in terms of impact to us as a species. Yeah, of course. There you could create an environment where there is no available renewable resource. You know, that whilst it's drifting around for free, it does sort of beg that question, doesn't it?
Thank you. Malcolm?
Lord Brothers was at the university in November, and he was given an honorary degree at the university, and he also gave the recent lecture on the triumph of technology. And one of the technologies that is available that Baxi will be launching this month is a Stirling engine boiler. So you can have an ordinary boiler heating your home, but at the same time it can be giving you a kilowatt of power. And there is a potential. If 6% are replaced every year, and we replace them with these boilers, then we can replace all the nuclear power stations that we currently have.
Thank you. Any other related to this from the audience? Chris, and then I'll toss it to you. Go ahead, Chris.
Regarding risks, as things stand at the moment, catastrophic climate change is something that's most likely to happen. You know, a situation where you've got most people in the world reduced to absolute poverty, near starvation, or even dying. I would suggest that nuclear power is one of these stopgaps that takes us through a period where we realise that we're going to have to look after our planet better.
Okay, so you see a nuclear power as a stopgap?
Yes.
Okay, and now does anyone from the audience want to relate to that?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Peter.
It isn't a stopgap until about 2020 or a bit later than that. And in the meantime, we've got probably about 5 years between 2015 and 2020 where we've got practically nothing left to create that the energy that we need. Unless we start now investing in the renewable infrastructure that we need, we'll have absolutely no energy production, or next to none. We haven't got any CCS, and the EU directives say that we've got to have clean production of energy. CCS may or may not give that. Nuclear may or may not give that. Renewables do. And if we decide to go down the nuclear route, all our money will go down that route, or there won't be enough investment left in the renewable route, and we'll have 5 years of incredible energy poverty.
Thank you. You said something, then we'll go back to yourself. Go ahead. And then if any one of the members want to say something.
It was said earlier we've got about 50 years left of uranium in the ground. We've been using uranium for 50 years, so surely we're at uranium now. So surely we should be running down on using uranium and nuclear power, rather than trying to go for another 30 or 40 years.
Now, the 50-year number was based on a doubling, trebling of what we're currently using, so it's not a linear consumption. We're talking about potentially trebling. The IEA talking about increasing consumption by a factor of 10. So that's why we're not halfway through. It's because it's increasing relative to previous demand. Relative to the question about what do we need to tackle climate change, it's different depending on which country you're in. But looking at as far as Britain is concerned, we have three huge potential answers and then a dozen little extras. And a dozen little extras will give you maybe 30%. But your three biggies are industrial scale wind, CCS, or nuclear. And you can say no to any two of those. You cannot say no to all three. So if you find all three objectionable, you are going to have to bite down and then say yes to at least one of those three.
Thank you. You want to say something?
I would like to speak.
Excuse me. I'll come back to you in a minute. Let me say something.
As a supporter of nuclear power in the medium term, I would be prepared to change my mind if it could be demonstrated that nuclear power actually had higher risks and was more dangerous than the other things. If, however, you read David McKay's book, you will find a very interesting sign which shows that nuclear power is actually the safest possible method of generating electricity compared with anything else per kilowatt hour generated.
Now, the slide in the Kaiser book is theoretical future danger. If you read the footnote on the same page, you find that his deaths per gigawatt year are actually 2.4. That's based on Chernobyl deaths of 9,000. As we said on many of the nuclear questions, if you ask how many people did Chernobyl kill, the honest answer is, we don't know. The range across a range of expert studies is 5,000 to 220,000. But that gives you a factor of 50 between your best and worst case of nuclear death. So the problem is this huge cloud of uncertainty around that deaths per gigawatt year. But his chart is a factor of 100 different to his footnote, which contains the historical figures.
Okay. Ian, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes. You probably got to, sorry, excuse me. Yeah, no.
Hold it a bit closer.
The first question that I was asking to come back on earlier was the measure of carbon equivalent or carbon dioxide equivalent, and why we haven't started looking at materials reciprocity as the measure of what the material will give. It's lifetime reciprocity. It costs so many joules, kilowatts, gigawatts. To get that material out of the ground, it will be turned into a production type of chemical form, whatever, and it will pay back a certain amount of energy while it's reciprocal material deficiencies. So, have you got any thoughts on that? Why there isn't an old kind of hell bent on global warming, CO2, get sorted out? The next part of the debate, and part of the debate, which transfers between nuclear and any other technology, is real reciprocity. Sorry, it's slightly long-winded.
So,
are
people clear about the question?
No.
Okay, can someone restate the question?
Yes. Well, essentially, it's a question about how much are you getting out of what you have to put into a material to produce power. Now, it's actually a very good question and something that needs to be considered with all of these things. One of the potential problems with certain areas is the uncertainty in figures. Because, for example, to use nuclear as the obvious example, I could choose a figure for particularly uranium grade, and no doubt somebody who was either more pro nuclear than I was would choose a different figure, and they could make a case for that, and somebody who was more anti it than I was could choose a different figure in the other direction and make a case for that. So there's always going to be an ambiguity in the figures, which I suspect is why that's a measure that people haven't tried to calculate, although I think it is one that people should try and calculate for all of the materials.
Okay, I'm going to have to sum it up because I want to get the vote in before anybody else leaves and we can continue a bit more. But before you, could you take the vote, the three of you, before we, would you mind?
Let them go, David.
Let them go. Okay, go ahead.
We should just get the proportions anyway.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take the vote now and then we can't carry on.
We'll take it after the vote because people might start going and the vote will mean meaningless
if a lot of people leave. Okay, so question one was, in light of the current challenges facing the UK and the world, do you feel we are compelled to have nuclear power as part of the primary energy mix? Yes is green, no is red. And D, you still don't know. So please raise them up. And I'm going to count the greens first, because I'm not colorblind. I'm just going to count the greens first.
The pinks can rest their arms.
The reds can rest their arms. The dots can rest their arms.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay, now the no's, please, raise them up, please.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19,
Okay, and then is there anyone who doubts? Raise their hand, please. 3, 4, 5, 5. Okay. Now, and then I'll go to the next question, then I'll tell you the results, okay? Because I don't want the results to sway how you answer the next question. Okay, next. There are fundamental reasons why nuclear power cannot and should not be part of the primary energy mix. So green is yes, no is red, and D is you just don't know yet. So please, will the greens raise their hand first, and then the reds can have a rest. Okay, and then the no's, please raise your hand. I am getting colorblind. And then the doubts. How many still doubting?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay, the results. Okay. On the first question, when you first said it was 27 for yes, second time 26 no. However, the no's went from 19 to 29. Okay, I'll say it again. The question was, in light of the current challenge facing the UK, do you feel we are compelled to have nuclear power as the primary? The yeses said, first time 27, and this time, second time 26. However, this time, the noes went from 19 to 29, an extra 10. And then the doubts went down to 5.
Whoa.
Okay? Is that clear now? Okay, I mean, you can call in the Florida Supreme Court for me, I don't mind. Okay, then, then two, there's a fundamental reason why nuclear power cannot and should not be part of the primary energy mix. Yes, the first time was 30, this time it went up to 34. And the no, 19, and it went up to 23. And then the undecideds went down to 5. From 9 to 5. So thank you very much. I do apologize if your question wasn't answered, but it was very tight. We had to put some aside, and
you're gonna ask this one question.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
I've just been told by the security guard that the building will get locked up in 15 minutes.
Okay.
So don't hang around. I'm gonna spend the night here. Okay. There's one gentleman with a bike who's going to need the security guard to get out. He's doing the roster of tasering students in the computer room at the moment. He'll be finished in 10 minutes and be able to meet him downstairs to get her bike. Thank you very much.
Pardon? Go ahead then.